Good morning, everyone. I'm now going to present a subset of the research that was conducted as part of this larger family planning reproductive health project. And I also have no relationships to disclose. I just want to start off by giving some background for the research that I conducted as part of this project. The National Survey of Family Growth, which is conducted by CDC, reports that over 10% of women in the U.S. report having fertility problems. And this is including women who are also having problems carrying their baby to term. And one of the most common causes for female infertility is pelvic inflammatory disease, which I refer to as PID. 10 to 15% of PID cases may lead to tubal infertility, and PID is usually caused by untreated chlamydia. The significance of this is that untreated chlamydia can spread into the uterus and causing damage, which leads to PID, so they're estimating that 10 to 15% of PID cases are caused by untreated chlamydia. And what you see here is a diagram where you can see untreated chlamydia leading to PID, leading to infertility, versus where if chlamydia is screened and diagnosed and treated, can actually prevent PID, which in turn leads to infertility prevention. There are several recommendations that are out by organizations such as ACOG and CDC that recommends that all women are screened under the age of 26 for chlamydia annually. These recommendations are important. The National Commission on Prevention Priorities actually ranked chlamydia screening as one of the top 10 clinical priorities based on its cost effectiveness, its ease of low current use rate, as well as its clinical preventative burden. The problem is screening rates are not optimal. CDC reports that the rates are 426 per 100,000. This is based off of 2010. And there was actually a report that came out this year by CDC saying this is one of the most unutilized screening tests that should be administered but is not. Healthy People 2020 actually has five specific goals that relate to STD screening as it relates to chlamydia screening, particularly for talking about the population of women that should be screened, also reducing the number of infections, as well as increasing the number of women who are screened not only in Medicaid but also commercial insurance plans, and in turn leading to a reduction in PID treatment in women ages 15 to 44. So here, this is just to demonstrate this is something that's really important for our nation, and actually being able to increase chlamydia screening, reduce the infection rates, will actually help us meet several of our Healthy People 2020 goals. How do community health centers play a role in this? We know that community health centers are treating a large number of patients, 28% of them being in reproductive health age. We know that they're providing care, as my colleagues have just presented from our research, that they're doing a lot in comprehensive family planning and reproductive health services. But the women who are being served in community health centers are the exact population that are most at risk for not being screened for chlamydia and even contracting chlamydia. 63% of the community health center population being minorities, 93% of those women being uninsured, which are the unfortunate populations that are disproportionately affected by chlamydia. Little is known about what's happening in the community health center setting as relates to screening for chlamydia and other conditions that may lead to infertility. So that's the significance of this research. Purpose of the study was really to look at the screening practice patterns at community health centers to see how often women are screened. Also, particularly to look at the relationships with the barriers as they relate to why community health centers are not able to screen on a routine basis, or if they are able to screen on a routine basis, what are the contributing factors? And then actually being able to delve deeper to look at how those factors are influencing screening patterns and how women are actually being screened at community health centers for whatever the barriers may be and how we can address those. So there are several research questions that I looked at. The first question being very basic, wanting to see, are asymptomatic women being routinely screened at community health centers, as well as asking them, do they perceive barriers? Do they think barriers even exist in their setting to providing screening? What would that most common barrier be? As well as looking at some of the characteristics of the community health center that actually may be related to how community health centers provide routine screening. Some of those characteristics include looking at patient volume, which is referring to how many annual patient visits are occurring there on an annual basis. Title X funding, the provision of STI testing and treatment, which we saw from our earlier presentation that they are doing that at a very high level, as well as provision of infertility counseling and treatment, and their family planning service volume, which relates to the number of family planning services, contraceptive services available on site. And lastly, the question I wanted to ask was, do CHC providers screen differently based on who they perceive to be at risk? Using a methods approach, looking at the survey results as well as looking at the case study interviews to answer these research questions. The survey responses actually answer research questions 1, 2, and 3. Research questions 2, 3, and 4 actually address through the case study interviews. So specific questions on the survey that address my research questions included, are asymptomatic women age 25 or younger who are sexually active routinely screened for chlamydia? And they were able to answer from the various categories, either saying yes, always, most of the time, sometimes, rarely, or never. Also asking them, do any barriers exist to routine screening for chlamydia, a yes or no question. And lastly, the survey asked, what is the most common barrier, which included time pressures, financial resources, staff awareness, discomfort discussing, or other. And they were actually able to write in an additional barrier that was not listed here. So here for my first research question, I just have a table just breaking down the frequency of screening that the community health centers actually reported. As you can see, over almost 50% reported that they always screen routinely for chlamydia. 40% said most of the time, and then a small percentage reported sometimes, rarely, or never. What I actually did was actually combine the other four categories to look at routine chlamydia screening for community health centers who reported they always screen versus those who do not always screen. And the do not always group included most of the time, sometimes, rarely, and never. And this screening categorization was made based on the fact that looking at this, you could see a really evenly divide of community health centers that are reporting always screening versus those that are not, and look at the comparisons between those two groups. For research question two, it was broken down into two parts, first being, are there barriers to screening, and then what's the most common barrier being reported for barriers to providing routine screening. And almost 30% of the community health centers reported that there are barriers. However, and I'll get into this a little bit later, many of them, though, did not report a common barrier. So, out of the respondents, only 108 actually reported what their actual barrier was. And so we are not really sure what the lack of response is there. So I have to state that because that kind of in fact affects the results and whether or not being able to see, okay, you're reporting that you have a barrier, but what is actually the barrier that you're experiencing at your site? I had hypothesized based on the literature that financial resources or staff awareness would be the most common barrier reported. And here that you can see, looking at these two categories, about 65% reported one or the other. And then for the other barrier type, that's referring to the write-in response, and which was pretty high. That was the second most common reported barrier, which was around 35%. And their write-ins varied from patients don't come back, that's why they don't screen, because they don't see them. A lot of wrote about the patient side being that the cost was on the patient and not being able to afford the screening. So when I placed this question on the survey referring to financial resources, referring to the community health center side, so I wanted to be specific about that. For research question three, this is looking at the characteristics of community health centers and how it's related to provision of routine screening. And out of all of the variables that I analyzed using the bivariate analysis, only three variables came out significant, and the level of significance being 0.05. As you can see here from the table, patient volume being, you know, CHCs that actually had higher patient volume were more likely to always routinely screen, as well as having receipt of Title Title X funds and reporting that a barrier existed. These are the three variables that were significantly associated with always providing routine chlamydia screening. Delving in further, looking at significant variables with each other, and based off of those interactions, ran a multivariable analysis. None of the variables that were interacting with each other came out significant. What was interesting was the patient volume variable dropped off. When actually adjusting for the other factors, patient volume was no longer significant, and the only two variables that remained significant in the multivariate analysis included receipt of Title X funds, as well as reporting no barriers. So now moving to the qualitative side, looking at the case study interviews, that allowed actually be able to delve more into getting a deeper understanding of why community health centers are not able to screen, what are the barriers, what are providers' perceptions, things that you can't necessarily address with a survey. And so this is a really good opportunity to have conversations with the providers on site about gaps, as well as things that they were doing that were working, that actually made them a model of, a model site for being able to routinely screen for chlamydia with their population. So what were some of the findings? We found that many of them reported, as well as they, which was consistent with the survey, that they are offering chlamydia screening during their pap, their annual pap smear exams with women. And some of the factors that they mentioned as being factors that they saw as red flags, or I need to make sure, I particularly make sure I ask my patient, is their patient, if they knew that their patient was sexually active, or their patient reported having multiple partners, which are the risk factors that are identified in the literature as being able to identify should this patient be screened. One of the biggest barriers that they reported, which was also consistent with the survey, was financial resources. But what was interesting was the conversation wasn't about so much financial resources on the community health center side. It was more commonly reported on the patient side, saying that patients refused the test because they couldn't afford the cost of the lab work, and therefore that was their biggest barrier to not being able to provide the screening. However, several case study sites reported that they are more in tune to routinely screening chlamydia because they happen to be in cities or states where they had a very, very high chlamydia infection rate, which I think really plays a factor into the provider's perception, awareness of why this is important to routinely screen versus a community health center or a provider who's operating in a state where they're not aware that chlamydia infection rates are really, really high, or that they have, they're serving in a community where many of their women are at greatest risk. What we did find from my case study is that providers are not screening based on who they perceive only to be at risk. They mentioned that some of the risk factors, such as having multiple sex partners and being sexually active, were, you know, things that they were listening for during their visits to see if that patient was someone that needed to be screened, but they didn't use that as their only determinant factor to screen. They were mentioning that, yes, we know that chlamydia rates are high, we know that this is a recommendation, we try to follow it, we don't base our screening recommendations on this person is of this particular race, this person is looks like they're having a risky sexual life. They really expressed that they were screening across the board based on the age guidelines and based on their sexual activity, and not just looking at race or the person has been in before for STD. I'm only going to screen women who I've seen who've had a STD history. Also, in the literature and other sites, it came up constantly that staff were not adequately trained for dealing with STI counseling and dealing with prevention and screening. That did not come up with our community health center site. And they were comfortable with discussing sexual topics with adolescents. What did come up was if they were in a community where it was very conservative and many of the parents didn't feel comfortable with the providers discussing sexual topics with their teenagers, that was something that was an issue. But it wasn't an issue that came up from the providers that I interviewed that they were uncomfortable discussing with teenagers, or they didn't have experience in discussing sexual health issues with adolescents. As I had mentioned briefly earlier, there were a lot of consistencies with the findings between the case study interviews as well as the survey responses. There was evidence that the sites are providing routine screening at every annual exam, and it also showed that the main barrier being reported on the survey was consistent with the case study interviews, that it is financial resources. I just want to point out, though, that there was more conversation about the financial resources barrier being more on the patient side. But I want to point out that two case study sites particularly mentioned, they said, you know, I'm saying that it's on the patient side, but it also reflects us, because if we have a patient who comes in who can't afford the cost of the lab work, we should have resources available to be able to provide that test. So I think it's important to mention that the community health centers were acknowledging that, yes, the patients may have financial barriers themselves, but they also need more resources so they can provide screening for these women who need this test, but they can't afford it. Case study findings also supported that Title X funds was very important. We found that community health centers who received Title X funds were more likely to be able to provide screening, and also sites that received Title X funding did not report financial resources as a barrier so much, particularly on the patient side, because they actually had a pot of money designated for women who did not have the money to cover the cost of services. And something that came out in a case study site that wasn't prevalent with the survey was, you know, providing STI treatment on site, having a large scope of family planning services made them be able to be more equipped to be able to make sure they're providing annual routine chlamydia screening. But that did not come out as a significant characteristic when actually looking at the survey results. We know the community health centers are doing a fairly good job. They're screening at a rate of 51%, which is higher than other clinic sites. Data shows that other clinic sites are annually screening for chlamydia at a rate of 40%. We know this rate is not optimal, but it does show that community health centers are doing better than other clinic settings in this area. Providers are aware that the guidelines exist. They just did not reference ACOG. For example, OBGYNs will reference ACOG. Non-OBGYN providers will reference CDC or their state health department's recommendations. And it's not that they just lack resources on the community health center side. It's an issue with the patients not being able to cover the cost of the screening. And the tests for chlamydia range for out-of-pocket costs range from $8 to $80, as reported from the sites in this study. Literature shows that for Medicaid expenditures, the cost can range from $10 to $103 for additional costs. So you can imagine someone who is living on a limited income, that could be a significant amount of money to have to pay at a visit just for a chlamydia screening test, in addition to whatever the sliding scale fee may be for their routine visit or whatever reason they're being treated at the community health center. What are the implications from this? CHGs obviously are a model. They're a model in other areas with chronic disease management. We've seen that community health centers do a really good job, and they're also doing a really good job in family planning services, as evident from this project. And they're a model even for routine chlamydia screening. Providers and patients need to be educated more about chlamydia screening contributing to fertility health. There may be a lack of knowledge in this area about how there's a connection between the screening and actually preventing PID, and actually addressing community perceptions. We have to get across the barrier where parents don't want providers to discuss sexual health issues with teenagers, when this is the time when women are most at risk for catching chlamydia and affecting their fertility health later in their 20s and 30s when they're trying to get pregnant. Also, looking at legislation as it relates to expedited partner therapy, where a provider is able to provide treatment for chlamydia for their partner without having the partner come in. There are several states that actually have legislation that allow this, and California is one of those states that allows expedited partner therapy. And also, as we look at funding issues, we know that Title X is very, very significant for community health centers in getting funding, Medicaid, because they serve a large population of Medicaid patients. And looking at screening programs, such as a program called the Infertility Prevention Program, which is funded by CDC, that provides states with funds to cover chlamydia screening tests. Unfortunately, because of lack of funds and so many sites needing services, many times community health centers are not the recipients of these type of screening program funds, because there are so many family planning clinics and health department clinics that get this money first, and then what is left over is available for community health centers, but in many states there are no funds available. So what's really important from this these research findings is that we need to really advocate for more funding for community health centers. They are serving a population in need, and they need the resources to continue to provide screening, particularly to reduce chlamydia infection and overall lead to fertility health for women. We look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have the panel come up here now, the speakers, and you can sit here and we can take questions. I think this panel of presentations is very interesting, looking at the study of the federally qualified health centers and community clinics, and then also looking internationally and looking how their numbers increase using a different type of person to provide the service. And as a lot of you know, community health workers in some states are used differently than other states, and some of the licensure requirements impact who can provide different kinds of clinical services too. So I'm always interested how they do things internationally different than domestically, since my work's been domestically. So questions?
Yes, I mean, those were actually the three top barriers that were reported, both in our case studies and in our survey. Largely the purchase of the devices themselves, and if any costs on the patient side, that tended to be reflected as one of the predominant barriers. Also having the right, the appropriately trained staff to actually deliver those services was also reported as a challenge that health centers have to navigate. And
it,
on a state-by-state basis, really.
I'm going to take the one in the back.
Do community health centers, either individually or as a group, to your knowledge, make any efforts to measure or track unintended pregnancy?
That wasn't a part of our study.
I know.
I'm not sure if you know about that.
If they do, it's really on a local level. Not on a national level that I know of, but I know health centers are very connected with their communities. They're very, a part of task forces and local efforts to track those exact unintended pregnancy and teen pregnancy. So on a local level, I would say yes.
And how would that be related to the coverage of contraception available? Any information there?
Unfortunately, we didn't really look at that in the survey, but some of our next steps are really to look at how patients' experiences with health care and family planning are represented and how that's linked with organizational delivery. So I hope that we'll be able to answer some of those questions in the future.
I think as they move to electronic medical records, health records too, that you'll be able to get some more data on that, because they'll be able to do a population-based analysis over time. So that might be a really good issue to look at in the future.
We did see in some of the sites very high rates of teenage pregnancy, and it was very interesting to us. The community health centers were very aware of those type of problems, but it didn't necessarily result in additional funding for those. And it was interesting also acceptance by the community of teenage pregnancy and different issues that the community health center stated to us around that issue. So it is something that needs to be addressed in the future.
Can you all hear the responses without them coming to the microphone?
Okay.
More questions?
I have a question. I mean, I work in a Title 10 environment, so I'm focusing just a bit on what you're saying. In that part, I know they were a minority in your overall survey, but it wasn't quite clear to me when you talked about the case studies and whether the Title 10 clinics would also see financial barriers in terms of the patient being able to afford things. Is that true also in that environment? Because I'm also interested in how Title 10 places will expand their services and if they see that as a barrier.
We did see that to some extent. It was supported as much as the non-Title X recipients, or non-recipients. But we did see that. We saw different types of barriers being reported by Title X-funded community health centers, which suggested that their programs were more developed. They had barriers around the community knowing that their services existed, and expanding the programs that they had, while community health centers that didn't receive Title X funding, their barriers were much more primary in nature, you know, just around funding and staffing.
You reported two different ways of organizing family planning services, integrated and clinics. Do you have an impression of which works better?
I was going to mention that. We really did not do an assessment that evaluated which method was better. But what we did see was that within those two models, there was variation. In the model where it's really embedded in comprehensive primary care services, we, through our case studies, we saw one site that really just did an unbelievable job of incorporating family planning services into their umbrella of primary care services. They did a great job explaining this to funders and to other healthcare organizations and creating partnerships and explaining to them that they need to support the community and these other partner organizations, that they need to support family planning because it was an essential part of primary care services, which is the mission of community health centers. And then we saw other clinics that had just, you know, family planning services out of their family medicine clinics and the OBGYN clinics. I would not like to speculate on which of those two were better. It would be an interesting next step for research to look at that. I think it's my impression was that it really depended on the clinic and how focused they were on family planning.
I had that as one of my questions, too, because I think that's a really interesting issue as we move forward with some of the health reform efforts, too, and thinking about which way clinics could reframe what they're doing. Do it, so that would be really interesting, too.
I was wondering if you had any sense of the data of what percent of women of reproductive age that go to the community health and actually get family planning services, not just that they offer them or they're available, but who's actually getting it.
Unfortunately, we don't have patient-level data at health centers that's not reported. We can tell, the one data point that we do have is contraceptive management visits. And so, I mean, I'd be happy to connect with you and share that, but it's very hard to get down to the patient level. It's a little too granular for what's reported nationally.
Well, they are counseled on all the methods available, you know, pills, condoms, and injectables. And they're also told that if they want IUDs or any other, you know, sterilization, any other method, they have to go to the clinics. So it's just because it's so popular that you can hide the fact that you're getting it from your husband, for one. And there was a lot of resistance from men to family planning, but to Child Fund's credit, they do a lot of sensitization in the communities to try and get past that barrier. But in addition to, you know, being a method that can be used clandestinely, it's also popular because you get a shot and 3 months you can, you know, not worry about family planning. So that's what makes it, of course, more popular than pills or even condoms, which the men often don't want to use.
Well, you talked about patients being unable to afford this premium. Do you know what kind of flag you feel about the cost of patient is for getting the premium?
So it ranged based on the community health center site. They have arrangements with whoever is their lab provider, who most of the time was contracted out from sites that we looked at in this project. And so it ranged. It wasn't a set fee. The lowest number
fat manual, their routine physical exam, one site reported the highest was $80 for their screening test. One state actually, which was participating in fertility prevention program funded by CDC, they don't charge at all for their test. So every woman that wanted, they offered the exam, the test to accept it. Except women who were married, who reported that they were in a monogamous relationship, or they just didn't want the test, they didn't feel like they needed it because they said they weren't sexually active. But that was a site where it cost a lot of issues. Those were the reasons why women did not get the test. But it ranged, and it's based on whatever the contract arrangement between their lab provider, which was oftentimes someone who was contracted out. And then in some states, if they partner with the health department, that would make a better relationship with the health department getting funds to cover the lab work, and then they can actually get the test at the lab work at a lower cost. But the cycle between the studies, that's not happening on a large scale, though the particular states that had better relationships working and networking together than others. So I think that's an area for improvement where community health centers and health departments can do more partnering and working together, because cost is an issue for everyone in this area who's trying to provide these tests. And particularly in fiscal times, it's going to constantly be a problem. And if you're offering a test that can range up to $80, you could see many women refusing if they don't have the funds to cover it.
Yes.
Sarah, you mentioned that especially certain reproductive services are difficult to access for uninsured patients. How do you see or anticipate this the result of your study changing as the Affordable Care Act?
Well, we know that more individuals will be covered by Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act. We are hoping that the results of our study will encourage either more Title X funding for community health centers or for some sort of funding, other types of funding for family planning services and community health centers be incorporated into the 330 funding that's there.
I know in some states like Minnesota, with Medicaid expansion and the waivers, that they're eligible to use those too. So that could change too, and especially, well, I said yesterday too, if they do have health insurance for young people being covered on their parents' insurance, if they people are working, then that will change things too, I think. More questions? The family planning registers, that was something they were already using, that Child Fund had developed. And it was designed to look similar to what they use in the clinics, because what they're supposed to do is every month, they're supposed to turn in their numbers, their family planning acceptors, new and continuing, their referrals, and they provide services other than family planning as well, so they need to turn in the records for those. As you can imagine, you know, depending on where they live and the weather, because, you know, the rainy season makes it very difficult, they just sometimes don't get their forms turned in on time. As a matter of fact, in our study, we made it the case that we hired six men and gave them six bicycles. So they were trained to ride out to these community health workers every month, sit down with them, extract the information from their family planning registers to put in our form that I told you we developed for our study. And then as a courtesy, they would take their family planning register forms and return them both to the Child Funds district office
and the district office for the district health office. So there is a plan, or there is the intention that the information works its way up to the district level and gets included in the HMIS. But as you can imagine, based on what I just told you, that doesn't always happen. Especially during the rainy season, for example. Or in one case, I remember one of the fellows was complaining that it was way too far to ride, even with a bicycle. And I remember I took one of the Land Rovers out to where this woman lived, and boy, I would never have found my way back. It really was far. The second question was what again? About
supervision.
Yeah, that's another problem. And you can see that by the cost that I mentioned, how much it costs to include the supervision and the training and everything. It's the same problem. It's transportation and getting around. So the CBD agents, because they're child funds CBD agents, they are supposed to be supervised by the district supervisor for child fund, as well as the clinic that they're affiliated with. All these CBD agents were affiliated with a clinic, and that's where they got their practicum training. And the in-charges or the nurses there, the ones who actually did the structured observation of them practicing their injections, they're supposed to provide supportive supervision. So again, that is written into the code. That's there, but it doesn't always happen because of ability to move around and transportation.
Thank you. Any more questions?
I have a question about the purchasing of the devices. Is the issue with the IUDs and the implants, they're just so expensive to stock that they don't want to put that money up front? Is that the issue?
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you for participating in this session. And again, it's sponsored by Population Reproductive Sexual Health Section and Management Sustainability Task Force. And right now you could add a second section for free. So if you're not a member of our section, you're welcome to do that. There's a little change form at the membership booth in the exhibit hall. So we encourage you to do that and be part of our section. Thanks for coming.